Hi, welcome back to the Engage This podcast. This is episode two, and we're going to discuss nude activism. Engage This is an open educational digital resource designed to help students and new activists answer the question, what can I do and how? A kind of toolbox that provides students and activists with the information they need to engage their communities for social change. The resource covers proven tactics and strategies, actions and campaigns, interviews with successful activists, as well as the information you need about the key movements and concepts that shape feminist and social justice activism. You can find out more at engagethis.org. Today, I am back with Ashley McFarlane, one of the editors of Engage This. Hi, Ashley. How are you today?
Hi, Kat. I'm awesome. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to be doing this one.
Me too.
All right. I guess I'll just jump in with the first question, which is, what is nude activism?
All right. So nude activism is really any action that utilizes the naked or exposed body in any way. It's effective because nudity is a significant cultural metaphor. The meanings of nudity in our culture are deep, complex, and layered, depending upon the context. So, for example, being exposed before someone, that can elicit feelings of shame, humiliation, fear, or alternately pride or power, especially erotic power. To expose another or to witness another's exposure can elicit feelings of guilt or shame in witnessing that, or laughter or mockery at witnessing that exposure. As well as feelings of arousal or eroticism. To pose nude in particular contexts is a significant symbol, especially for purity, innocence, or of symbols of nature or of the natural world. Meanings of nudity are complex, but they're not universal necessarily. Nude actions emphasize the body, and the naked female body is already saturated with meaning, much of it bound up in the antagonism between various dualisms. So I'm talking about divisions like culture and nature, reason and passion, and of course, mind and body. The body is culturally and historically associated with women and has been characterized as being closer or having privileged access to nature or the spiritual world. Modern Western culture is built from the belief that the purpose of mankind is to conquer and improve nature, and our material world and its fleshy bodies are subordinated, and they've, you know, been fodder for the fire in that quest. So nude actions demonstrate the links between the subjugation of women and people of color, the destruction of the environment, as well as globalized capitalism. Groups that have historically drawn on nudity as a tactic are women, people of color, indigenous people, and the poor, groups that otherwise lack a platform or a vehicle for their protest, their dissent. Nude actions have been used for a variety of different causes too. So they've been used to protest sexual exploitation, violence against women, political oppression, war, nuclear weapons, religious fundamentalism, and protest for LGBTQ rights, labor rights, animal rights, reproductive rights, and even just the right to be naked in public, like the Free the Nipple movement, or which is so women can go around topless in public without, getting a ticket. As well as lactivists who stage public breastfeeding sit-ins to go against the stigma of a woman breastfeeding her baby in public. It's also commonly used, nude actions are also commonly used in environmental activism to protest environmental destruction, industrial pollution, climate change, genetic engineering, neocolonialism, and corporate globalization. Like I said earlier, nudity is a pretty profound cultural metaphor. There's no standard meaning attached to the action. In fact, the meaning attached to nudity is often complex and sometimes contradictory, but these actions are difficult to understand without linking them to issues of gender, sexuality, and power. And actions that utilize the nude for, or actions that emphasize the nude form tend to use the tactic precisely for that link, whether they do it consciously or not.
Gotcha. Awesome. And then what sparked your interest in nude activism specifically?
So if you listened to the podcast before this, this project came out of Feminist Activism 101, which was Stacey, Dr. Keltner's first blog, her public scholarship blog. And I started doing writing articles for that blog in 2013. And I just really on accident stumbled across Femin when I was doing my research. Femin is a protest group that I'll talk about them a little bit more later, but they're based in Paris right now, but they started in Ukraine as a group that protested the sex trafficking and the sex industry in Ukraine.
Yeah, I remember learning about them in her class, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was my first, we watched like a documentary and stuff on them.
Oh, yeah. Which was that the one that was on Netflix?
I think it was on like Apple TV or something. It might have been on Netflix, but
there are a couple of different ones out there. But I learned about them. It was around 2013, I guess, and they became really active in they were really coming to broad awareness around 2012. Okay. So I started researching Femin, and then I was doing a research paper for a class I was in on social movements, and I decided that I wanted to research nude protests. So I started looking at various other different groups, and I just came up with so many. There are so many different groups that utilize nudity or naked action in some form. It's almost impossible to categorize or to, list them all. But yeah. I really became interested in nude activism, and Stacey suggested that we write a book about it. And it feels like we've been writing this book forever, but good books take a long time to write, or at least.
I remember you guys talking about that book too, like a couple years ago when I first started having you two as teachers.
Oh, yeah. Well, stay tuned. It's but yeah, we both are incredibly interested in these actions because they're steeped in meaning. Mm-hmm. The action itself, it's the easiest thing to do because it requires literally nothing. Like there's nothing needed for it. And as I've said a couple of times already, it's such a significant metaphor culturally. Then, like I said before, there's no standard meaning attached to it, but it's difficult to understand without linking it to power, sexuality, gender. So there is one Australian feminist philosopher who I've done a lot of reading on, who has done, I guess, a lot of research herself on nudity and nude protest. Her name's Ruth Barcon.
Yeah.
So did you read her in, I think I know what class you took with Stacey. It was a gender and pop culture class, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the exact one. Yeah. I actually used that book for a paper I just recently did. So
I love that book. It's an interesting book. So in that book, Nudity, A Cultural Anatomy, Barcon says there are four currents of historical, meaning that lend context to nude actions made by women. The first draws upon the, ancient life-giving associations of female nudity, like the ancient fertility goddesses. So she mentions some of the oldest pieces of ceramic art are in the shape of a woman, a naked woman with voluptuous breasts and buttocks, and also with exaggerated genitals. She's a fertility talisman. So that's the first meaning. The second draws upon more sinister ideas associated with female sexuality, like castration and death. So there are many ancient myths associated with vagina dentata, for example, though not all of them are of that name. So for example, in India, they have several different versions of a toothed vagina that castrates men. And one particularly horrifying example, wealthy landlord commands three peasants to rape a beautiful young woman that he wants to take as his bride, but he's afraid of her toothed vagina. In another story, there's a woman that has a snake that, or a snake crawls up a woman's vagina and bites off this man's penis who tries to rape her. A lot of these stories really revolve around punishment for rape. Russia has a similar myth of a young woman who's forced to take a husband that she doesn't want, so she puts a fish head, a toothed fish head, up her vagina so that the fish's teeth will cut him. And South Africa, Japan, New Zealand, Chile all have similar vagina dentata mythologies. There's also the Korean kamiho, the nine-tailed fox that devours men during intercourse. If you guys saw Lovecraft Country recently, that is a storyline in that show. Of course, Greek mythology also gives us quite a few mythologies that reveal their discomfort with female power. The bare-breasted, self-mutilated Amazon warrior. The Amazon women murdered their male children. And there's, of course, Medusa with her serpentine locks, whose gaze was so deadly that men were turned into stone. And of course, we haven't really left these mythologies in the past either, because Sigmund Freud's castration complex also reflects the same misogyny. And female mm-hmm. genital mutilations are still performed on over 3 million girls every year. Baruch Barkan, a third historical meaning, draws upon the neutralization of femininity and an emphasis on the universal body or the saintly body. And the final current of historical meaning draws upon the power of the female body when it's functioning as an object of the male gaze, or harnessing the power of eroticism, sexuality.
Yeah, I loved that book. I kept it after I finished that class. I loved it so much.
I know. My copy is like, it's the spine is broken and the pages are all falling out. So.
Okay. Who are some, I know we've kind of already addressed a few of them, but who are some key nude activists or activist groups that come to mind when discussing the topic, like right off the bat? I mean, obviously we talked about feminine and kind of culture, but what are some, all right, I guess, groups that we could follow now?
All right. Hang on to your hats. So, here. So I guess I'm going to talk about it first, sort of group them by meaning, the meanings that I talked about that Barkan discusses in her book. So first I want to talk about those ancient meanings behind the action, the ones that would invoke those sort of ancient fertility goddess life-giving properties. So that those meanings are often invoked by environmental and peace activists. So in the past two decades, many different anti-war activists have used some sort of exposure stripping down to protest military action overseas. Breasts Not Bombs is a group that was really popular on the West Coast in California. It was organized by a person named Sherry Glaser, who she was a performance artist in Berkeley, California, and she formed this group to express disapproval for the invasion of Iraq. On her website, she states that, quote, "We reject that exposing our breasts in public is indecent. We say that torture and cluster bombs are." So there again, they're saying, why is it that it's illegal for me to bare my breasts in public, but you're allowed to kill innocent civilians? There's a similar group, or not really very similar, a group that also draws upon these meanings called Bearing Witness. So this group, they use their bodies to spell out words like peace or truth, vote, I've also seen, and messages like no war, just like lots of people laying down to form these words, and then they're photographed from above, and then they sort of circulate these photographs on social media. There's also La Tigresa. Her story is one of my favorites. She's also a performance artist in Mendocino, California. She goes by the name Donna Sue Scissors, and she was staying with friends in Mendocino Valley, and she kept seeing all of these logging trucks going up the mountains into the redwoods and coming back with all of these, you know, gorgeous giant redwood trees. These trees are the oldest living things on the planet. And she couldn't bear to watch them all be cut down. So one day she went out there alone, took her shirt off, and stood in the middle of the road blocking all of the logging trucks, and just stood there reciting poetry with a megaphone. And it was her own poetry, poetry about the earth as a goddess. It's quite moving. And she, you know, she writes about it. She writes about these men just being absolutely stopped in their tracks. Like they were stunned and speechless at this woman just standing in the middle of the road without her shirt reciting poetry. You know, they weren't able to do their job that day. They had to turn around and go home. So that, you know, that day she was quite effective. So some art activists who do the nude action a little bit differently, I've talked about them a little bit before already, are Femin. So Femin is a global movement now headquartered in Paris, and they're almost pop culture icons now, but they began in in 2008 to protest sex trafficking in the sex industry in Ukraine. Their tactics are anarchist and extreme for sure. One of their leaders, Inna Shevchenko, fled Ukraine and now lives in Paris because she cut down a cross with a chainsaw in Kiev. It's a pretty badass video if you look
at it. Yeah, that was in the documentary for sure. Didn't pretty much all of them have to flee for one reason or another?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that most of them live in Paris now. And one of the activists recently passed away too, I learned.
Yeah, 2018. I remember I read some stuff about that.
So Femin, they promote the ideology of what they call sextremism, which I assume is, you know, the shortened version of sexual extremism. But on their website, they say their, quote, mission is protest. Their weapon is bare breasts. And I don't know if this was in the documentary. There's a Vox video, I believe, where a journalist goes and interviews a bunch of the Femin activists. And there's this really cute little punk song that they make out of this slogan. She's like, our name is Femin. Our God is woman. Our mission is protest. Our weapon is bare breasts. So you'll be thinking that all day now.
Yeah, I probably will for sure.
So they also say on their website, and this is a quote from them, we live in a world of male economic, cultural, and ideological occupation. In this world, a woman is a slave. She is stripped of the right to any property, but above all, she is stripped of ownership of her own body. All functions of the female body are harshly controlled and regulated by patriarchy. Separated from the woman, her body is an object to monstrous patriarchal exploitation, animated by production of heirs, surplus profits, sexual pleasures, and pornographic shows. Complete control over the woman's body is the key instrument of her suppression. The woman's sexual demarque is her key to liberation. Manifestation of the right to her body by the woman is the first and the most important step to her liberation. Female nudity free of patriarchal system is a grave digger of the system, militant manifesto and sacred symbol of women's liberation. That's the end. So I think Femin's use of nudity embodies the second and the fourth of Barkhan's contexts. They're inverting the mythology of the dangerous, sexually empowered, free woman exemplified through her nudity, while also capitalizing on the attention that their exposure brings them. Because if you look at pictures of Femin, most of the activists are thin, white, cisgendered, able-bodied. This is something that they're often criticized for their lack of inclusivity and promoting gender essentialism. They're also accused of being Islamophobic and Orientalist. And I guess I haven't exactly explained to anyone listening, if you haven't seen pictures of Femin, so what they'll do is wherever they show up, it's really a guerrilla style tactic. Wherever they show up, they usually have slogans written on their chests, which are bare. They have flower wreaths across on top of their head. And that's just kind of their look. So outside of political activism, many other social movements utilize the naked form, like lactivists, who I said before stage public breastfeeding sit-ins, and naturists and closed free activists who will attend and promote clothing optional events for adults and entire families, just to promote the public acceptance of nudity and positive body images. But nude activism isn't always just about stripping oneself. It can also be about stripping another or publicly exposing them. To be stripped in public is one of the oldest forms of cultural shaming. Slaves and prisoners, for example, have been forced to have their heads shorn or to go barefoot or to be fully or partially stripped for public floggings or for public exposure. And these aren't necessarily historical examples just historical examples. Consider the now iconic series of photos leaked in 2004 from, that take a look at the Abu Ghraib military prison in Iraq. So in a lot of in these photos, there's Lindy England was the soldier's name. She's she's present in a lot of them. There's one where she's posing behind a pyramid of naked men. These are detainees at Abu Ghraib military prison. In another, she's smoking a cigarette and pointing at the genitals of a man who was forcibly stripped and hooded and forced to simulate masturbation for the camera. In another shot, she's giving a thumbs up while she's crouching next to a dead, stripped Iraqi man. The images depicted brutal physical abuse, sexual humiliation, and torture. And the photos depicted actions that were characterized as, quote, isolated incidents by the U.S. government. But years later, the torture memos, revealed this was a pattern. There was a pattern of physical and sexual abuse, rape, sodomy, and torture at American detention facilities overseas, including facilities in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay. So there's also the walk of shame, naked or partially naked. And this has historically been reserved for women and generally tied to perceived sexual deviancy or sexual transgression. So contemporary usage usually refers to a woman leaving the house of a hookup. She's not naked, but she's wearing the clothes that she had on the night before. So she's shamed on her way home for her, her perceived sexual promiscuity. But the walk of shame in medieval Europe usually referred to prostitutes or women who were accused of adultery, were forced to walk public in while stripped to the waist or wearing only a sheet or in some cases completely nude to, demonstrate their sexual transgressions. We also remember this from the Game of Thrones. If you guys are Game of Thrones fans, you might remember the scene where Cersei must atone for her sexual shame. But this scene was actually based on an actual historical event. Cersei's Walk of Atonement represented the 1483 public shaming of Elizabeth Shore, who was a mistress to the British king, Edward IV, I believe. And upon his death, his brother was successor to the throne, and he said that Elizabeth was trying to conspire against him, and he forced her to walk through the streets completely naked. More recently, in 1944, women accused of collaborating with Nazis or sleeping with Nazis were forced to walk through the streets of Paris barefoot with their heads shorn. So what's significant about the naked walk of shame or naked walk of atonement is that it's not just punishing a woman for doing something wrong. She didn't just do something wrong. She wasn't guilty. She was something wrong, and she needed to feel ashamed for what she was. Now, these sorts of public humiliations also take place online. The internet is a very powerful tool that can be used by anyone and, impersonally, anonymously, and without consequences in many cases. Women are the most consistent object of online shaming, And shaming most often takes the form of rape threats and jokes about rape. And the most striking, really, similarity to the walk of shame is in internet culture is the existence of revenge porn, where, you know, a nude photo of someone or someone who happened to have a digital picture of themselves lifted off their computer or phone, somehow that is circulated on the internet without their permission. But, consent, inviting trolls and just anyone to shame them in chat rooms, social media. And there's, once it's out there, there's really no way to get something off the internet. It doesn't matter how hard you try, it's there. But some of the most powerful uses of nudity, I think, have happened when women have used their own naked bodies to overcome shame or to redirect misplaced shame or just to shame other people. So in these instances, the naked body becomes the means of shaming someone else rather than, you know, the vehicle of one's own shame. So there are two notable examples that come to mind here. The first takes place in India in 2004. So on July 15th, 2004, 12 elderly women gathered at the gates of the Kangla Fort in Imphal, which is a capital city of Manipur. Manipur is a state in the northeast region of India. These women stripped fully naked and unfurled a large white banner that read, "Indian Army, rape us," and another that said, "Take our flesh," in bright red paint. These women were members of a local social justice organization known as Mirapabis, or in English, the Torchbearers. They're one of many active women's organizations in Manipur. Manipur is a state that has experienced political and social subjugation by the Indian state for decades and functioned under routine surveillance and violence by the Indian state. But it's also a state that has consistently staged resistance to the efforts by the Indian states to disenfranchise, criminalize, and humiliate its people. The women, the elderly activists that gathered that day to protest, the violent rape and murder of a 32-year-old woman named Thangjam Manorama. She was murdered. They accused the Assam Rifles of being her murderers. The Assam Rifles are an Indian paramilitary group, and they have pretty much unchecked power in the Manipur region, under a document called the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. I'm going to call it AFSPA because it's a lot shorter. So AFSPA is a law under which the armed forces enjoy extraordinary power, including the power to arrest, search, and shoot to kill without question in India's northeast states, which include Manipur, also Kashmir. AFSPA was first enacted in the northeast region in 1958, in response to armed opposition of indigenous tribes towards the Indian government following India's independence from Great Britain in 1949. So this young woman, Thangjam Manorama, was placed under arrest by the Assam Rifles at her home in Imphal, which is the capital city, in the really early morning hours, like 3 a.m. or something, maybe a little bit before that, on July 11th. They claimed that she was involved with a secessionist group called the People's Liberation Army. So there's a law that says any person who's arrested under the Armed Forces Special Powers Act needs to be handed over to the civilian authorities within 24 hours. So she was abducted from her home at 3:30 a.m. She was not presented, her family was not presented with any evidence of guilt. She was abducted and her body was then found 2 hours later, only 4 kilometers away from her home. The Assam Rifles alleged that they shot her while she was trying to run away, trying to escape, but her body, indicated a different story. She was, bruised and bloody, and there were indications of rape and torture. So these soldiers were all protected by the federal authority of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. They've never been held accountable for her murder. Nobody has. So the indigenous people of the northeastern region, which is connected to mainland India by only a very small strip of land, share more ethnic and linguistic links to Southeast Asia and the greater Himalayan region than the Indian mainland. So in both mainland India and in the Northeast region itself, there's this belief that the region will never be a true part of India, that they're somehow different. So the belief is partly constructed from colonialist understandings of the region as populated with, quote, savage, backwards people. And this belief still reproduces stereotypes that that negatively characterize the people of that region. So after her death, there were widespread protests in the region, leading to city curfews, which were mostly ignored, by vigils and marches. There was a large labor strike, plus this famous nude action at the Kangal Fort. The women that performed this action said they had never done anything like this before, even though they were all veteran activists. So they had never taken off their clothes or disrobed in any way before. But many of them had visited the morgue and seen Manorama's body, and they saw the mutilation of her body, and they were just so profoundly distraught by the violent end to her life that they felt that the usual methods and tactics of resistance that they had relied on just seemed trivial, futile, hackneyed, and none of them carried the potential to shock or to shame the perpetrators. None of them could return the fury and revulsion that these women felt inside, except for that nude action. So that's why they decided to strip off their garments. Many of them described her murder as a violation or an assault on the dignity of all women. They explained that because the Assam Rifles, and by extension the Indian state, had no respect for the bodies of women, there was just no point at all in wearing clothes. One of them said, "After I saw the body, it was not difficult for me to strip. I was agonized." The nude protest led to chaos, one of the protesters said. There was a curfew imposed, schools and government offices were shut down. The women escaped without arrest initially, but were later arrested and released. In response to the protests, the Indian government established review committees to assess the value of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. One of these, the Reddy Commission, gathered information from communities, lawyers, academics, activists, and they found that AFSPA was obscure and easily abused, and it was a symbol of oppression in the Northeast, and it should be repealed. But there were no steps taken by the Indian state to repeal it. And that's still the case to this day. For the second notable action, we're going to Nigeria. Women in Africa have historically drawn on the power of the body to address community grievances and, in more recent times, to resist imperial or institutional oppression. While different regions of the continent attach different meanings to what they call the curse of nakedness, they all draw upon the maternal, life-giving properties of the body as a way of publicly shaming someone or a group of people. So perhaps one of the most well-known deployments of the curse of nakedness happened in the summer of 2002 in the Niger Delta region of Nigeria. So on July 8th of that year, hundreds of unarmed women from the rural Niger Delta region laid siege to an oil terminal that was owned by Chevron Texaco in Escravos, and they stayed there for 10 days. Their numbers eventually swelled into the thousands as women from various other tribes in the region blocked six other Chevron flow stations across the delta. These women were they were a community of mothers, grandmothers, ranging in age from 30 to 90, and they were demanding that the oil companies in this region clean up the environment, provide jobs for their children and husbands, build schools and houses for tribal elders, and support local farming and other subsistence measures. In order to have their demands met, these women threatened to employ a regional superstition that is known as the curse of nakedness. In this superstition, By exposing their genitals, they take back the life force that a woman gives at birth. So for a man, the shame of being pointed out with a mother's breasts or vagina initiates a social death among tribal members that is believed to lead to actual death in some cases. So in this region, environmental destruction and poverty is a result of the economic policies imposed after the end of the colonial period and the discovery of oil in the Niger Delta in the 1970s. The extraction of this oil has completely devastated the land and waters around the Niger Delta. International oil companies reduced this once agriculturally rich land to a dirty, polluted wasteland where nothing will grow. So a spokesperson for a group of one of the protesters said, quote, "We are tired of complaining. The Nigerian government and their chevron have treated us like slaves. They've been threatening us that if we make noise, they will stop production and leave our community and we will suffer, as if we've benefited from them. Before the 1970s, when we were here without chevron, life was natural and sweet. We were happy. We used to catch all sort of fish and bush animals, but the oil pollution killed everything." So there was this massive oil spill off the coast of Nigeria in 1998. It was the largest in Nigeria's history. And this oil spill is what compelled many of the women to begin challenging the oil industry. Another activist, you know, recounts that after that oil spill, there were just dead fish everywhere in the water. And she explains that now, fishermen in the region, they have to travel several miles off the coast for the chance at catching fish because the water near the coast is so dirty and polluted with oil. But it's very difficult for them to get that far off the coast because they don't have boats that are capable of going those distances safely. This lack of fish is particularly impactful for women in the community who had made their living from trading fish and vegetables in the market, but now they're unable to do that because of the polluted oil, soil, and acid rain in the region. So in August of that same year, 2002, the protesters, whose numbers at this point were up to 4,000 people, published an ultimatum that was circulated to Chevron Texaco worldwide, demanding immediate action on the promises of employment of 25 men over a period of 5 years, and financing for the building of hospitals, schools, fish and poultry farms, or else they would expose themselves, signifying with that action that they were ready to die for their cause. The threat of the curse of nakedness resulted in global visibility and resulting global solidarity. Okay. A leader in the movement went on to argue that oil producing communities in the United States, the ones in Tulsa, the ones in Texas, did not look like the ones in the Niger Delta. So they used this solidarity with others. They employed their nakedness as a way to show multinational corporations, specifically the oil industry, that globalization goes both ways, that women are suffering excessively under the advance of global capitalism, but they can also use that visibility, or use globalization to increase their visibility, to be witnessed by people on the opposite end of the planet.
That's so much that I never knew before. So that's amazing. So you kind of mentioned nudity and then you also said the word nakedness. So what is the, can you describe the difference between the two words? Like, I know it doesn't sound like there's a difference. I mean, to you it does, but it doesn't sound like there's a difference between the two.
Yeah.
But,
so the primary difference I would say is the function of the gaze. So I'm going to turn here to John Berger. And you probably watched his documentary Ways of Seeing in your class, didn't you? So in that documentary, he's evaluating 19th century European oil paintings, and he makes a distinction between nudity and nakedness. So he explains that to be naked is to, quote, to be oneself, whereas to be nude is to be seen naked by others. A naked body has to be seen as an object in order to become a nude. It has to be posed in a particular way. It has to have an intention to be seen in a particular way. To be naked is, you know, you're naked in the bathtub. You're not nude in the bathtub. I mean, you might be if, you know, you can be nude in the bathtub, I guess. But, you know, generally being naked is when you're not being looked at. So to be nude is to be seen by another, to be witnessed by a spectator. The nude body is a naked body on display. So Berger explains in the European tradition, women were the ever-recurring subject of nude paintings and were presented as passive, available, an object for men to consume. Berger's distinction allows us to understand nude as representation and nakedness is just being. Nude is a representation that transforms women into an object, a visual object to be consumed. And this, of course, laid the groundwork for Laura Mulvey's conception of the male gaze in cinema. So the idea that women are presented in film, television, advertising as sexual objects to be consumed.
Okay, yeah. I remember, because I remember when I was going over the questions for this with a friend of mine, I got to this question and they kind of looked at me crazy. And I was like, no, there is a difference. I just can't remember what it is right now. But we'll find out in a few days, you know? But, okay. So, you know, the whole time, obviously, we've been talking about nude activism. That's the whole point of this podcast episode. So I guess in your opinion, what is the importance of nude activism and what kind of impact can it have?
This is such a difficult question. I struggled with it the most. I don't know if I think it's more important than any type of activism. I think it's more interesting than a lot of types of activism. I think it can have a larger impact in certain contexts and for certain causes. I think it can signal an urgency or a gravity that wasn't there before. I think it can also be really effective in getting attention, of raising awareness of something or bringing a more serious awareness to an issue. I think the women of the Niger Delta were really effective. Well, actually the women in India too. So both of those examples were notable for precisely that fact. The awareness was already there. There had already been, you know, agitation around, well, for example, environmental destruction in Nigeria and sexual abuse of women in India. But elevating it to the next level, you know, bringing their naked bodies to the forefront made it seem more urgent, more grave, something that needed to be paid attention to right now. PETA, I think, is also really successful in using nudity in that way. They've used nudity in quite a few campaigns, but one that really comes to mind is the photos of they had women painted bloody and packaged up as meat. Like, I mean, that's really, that's just like, whoa, meat, you can't unsee that. It really makes you rethink how easy it is for us to, you know, get a steak at the grocery and not have to think about where that came from. And, you know, not just, I mean, there's so much destruction.
I think PETA sometimes will take a lot of what they do to the extreme, but sometimes that's the only way they can get their point across with certain things. You know, things like that. Like, it seems like, oh, that's super extreme until you kind of think about it a little bit more. And it's like, well, that's the only way that point is really going to get
across.
And then,
you know, I think like that really brings me back to La Tigresa. She wouldn't have been as effective standing there in the middle of the street just screaming poetry at these men if she was fully clothed. Started out fully clothed, but they didn't get attention. So that's why they took their tops off and they started getting attention. So there's just certainly something to be said about that.
I think one thing that Femin said and kind of did really well is that, you know, they could go out and do what they're doing fully clothed and still make the paper, but it's about what's going to make the front page and stay there. So, but yeah, I felt like there was one more thing I was going to I don't know if you saw these pictures, but you know, with Instagram and social media and stuff, especially because of a lot of my friends who are photographers and who do a lot of like nude photography, talking about kind of like the censorship of like the female nipple. I don't know if you saw the picture where it was like a bunch of naked women laying in the road and they just had like pictures of nipples like on their, I think it was on their faces or something. Trying to make that point, like not trying to like censor the female form, the female nipple, as if it's
Yeah, I
something
haven't seen
bad.
that. I know that, you know, the hashtag free the nipple has been around for a while. And lots of folks, you know, stage nude sit-ins and topless sit-ins. Top free is also a hashtag, so that women can go top free without, you know, being ticketed in public areas where men are able to be shirtless. So yeah, there's so much involved. It's a very rich topic.
So much. Yes. And
It's
we
impossible
didn't even
to.
cover
That's
all of it,
why the book's taking so long.
That definitely makes sense. All right. Is there anything else you would like to
I don't think
include
so.
before we wrap up our episode?
Thank you so much for letting me talk about this topic. It's so much fun for me and so very interesting to me.
It's very fun for me to listen to. That was my first class with Dr. Keltner. I think it was the semester after I took your class and decided to pursue gender studies more full time. So I've been itching to learn more about nudity and nude activism and things like that. So this was
So
amazing for
excellent.
me as
Thank you so
well.
much, Kat.
Thank you for joining me. All right, everybody, we will see you on the next podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you again so much,
Thank you, Kat.
Ashley.
It was
It's always
great
so much
talking to
fun.
you.